10120 to 10124. Congratulations to KBS World Radio, celebrating its 70th
Somi, and you're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM, hands-on creative community radio for Greene and Columbia County.
Find out where the music takes you on the next Deep Threes when the final recording sessions of the Robert Honer Percussion Ensemble see the light of day. Plus the explosive orchestra sounds of the Dorf Sound Collective and Kamasi Washington. Deep Threes. Music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Do you enjoy the arts, have an interest in art classes and meeting your local creative community? Then join us at the Athens Cultural Center on the first Friday of each month from 5 to 7 p.m. View our latest exhibition over free nibbles and drinks hosted by our ACC board members. And get to know us. We are at 24 2nd Street in Athens and online at athensculturalcenter.org. We look forward to meeting you.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's how you cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
This is Brian DeWan. I leave my clock radio tuned to 90.7 FM so that when it goes off in the morning, the first thing I hear is WGXC.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Luke Parsno reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul signed a bill that bans the dumping of radiological waste from the Indian Point Energy Center nuclear plant into the Hudson River. Hochul said, and I quote, "The Hudson River is one of New York's landmark natural treasures, and it's critical we stand together to protect it for generations to come. My administration remains committed to protecting the economic vitality of the region and working closely with local communities who have advocated so passionately for this cause," end quote. The only opponents of the bill were a labor union that represents workers at the Westchester County site and the owner of Indian Point, who said the measure is unnecessary and could cost jobs. When it was open, Indian Point routinely dumped radiological waste into the Hudson River, as other nuclear plants around the country do in different bodies of water. Indian Point had been delaying a planned release because of opposition throughout the Hudson Valley. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Andrea Makel reports for Porcupine Soup that next month the Cairo Town Board might allow a solar farm on the 30 acres at the former Joel M. Austin Road landfill. Two companies, 42 Renewables of Westchester County and SOL Source Power LLC of Troy, want to put solar farms there. The proposal from 42 Renewables is to create 4 megawatts of power, and SOL would create 6. Because the landfill was closed in the 1970s before current regulations, it was not capped to today's standards. In January, New York's Department of Environmental Conservation said that agency, and I quote, is supportive of solar projects located at closed solid waste landfills, which align with the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act mandate of 6 gigawatts of photovoltaic solar generation by 2025, end quote. Town Supervisor Jason Watts said, and I quote, we are going to look at both of your proposals, end quote. Read more about this story at Porcupine Soup. Mid-Hudson News reports that House of Representatives Speaker Kevin McCarthy is coming to Sullivan County next week for a private fundraiser for Mark Molinaro. Molinaro's 19th district seat is expected to be among the country's most contested in next year's election, as Molinaro's win in 2022 helped give Republicans a narrow majority in the House. Anyone except the media with $75 can attend, but the location is a secret told only to those who pay. Former Governor George Pataki and former local Congressperson John Faso will also attend the fundraiser. Molinaro represents the 19th Congressional District, which includes Greene and Columbia counties. Read the full story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. You can visit our website at WGXE.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXE sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXE newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
In honor of National Honeybee Day, New York environmentalists want Governor Hochul to sign the Birds and Bees Protection Act. The bill prohibits selling neonicotinoids and use of seeds coated with these pesticides. It also requires the state's Department of Environmental Conservation to review the latest science concerning active ingredients in them. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency finds neonicotinoids can jeopardize more than 200 plant and animal species protected by the Endangered Species Act. State Senator Brad Hoylman Siegel, the bill's Senate sponsor, describes some impacts these pesticides can have.
In addition to driving down the populations of critical pollinators like bees as we celebrate International Honeybee Day, neonicotinoids are linked to a host of health problems in humans, including neurological damage and birth defects.
In humans, neonicotinoids are linked to altered insulin regulation and lower testosterone levels. The legislature approved the bill last year, though Governor Hochul vetoed it, citing the Department of Environmental Conservation's current regulatory role and its stringent pesticide program. The EPA made interim decisions on these chemicals, such as restricting when pesticides can be applied to blooming crops to limit exposure to bees. Corinne Hanch, owner of Love and Mama Farm, says these pesticides aren't as beneficial as pollinators are.
Corn and wheat grown from neonic-coated seeds cause near-instant death to any insect who touches these plants. And we are seeing dangerous levels of insect die-off. Farmers, like me, we rely upon insects, i.e. pollinators, for our fruiting crops and our seed crops. Plus, we rely upon beneficial insects for pest control.
A study in the journal Nature finds exposure to neonicotinoids reduced a honeybee's ability to survive in winter. Between 2020 and 2021, beekeepers across the U.S. saw 45% of their colonies die off. Connecticut's General Assembly considered a similar bill this year, but it wasn't approved. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and Philip Grant up in Rensselaer County and I are bringing you the WGXC Congressional Report, full of stories about what the candidates and representatives from the New York 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st Congressional Districts have been up to this past week. Go to WGXC.org in the WGXC newsroom for complete coverage of your congressional representative.
CBS reports that 3 Republican political operatives agreed to pay more than $50,000 in restitution and penalties in Ohio for their parts of a phony charity that collected money purportedly to help victims of the East Palestine train derailment. One of the 3 men, Luke Mahoney, is a former campaign staffer for Representative Elise Stefanik, who represents Rensselaer County and the rest of the 21st Congressional Districts. Mahoney is barred from starting, operating, or soliciting contributions for any charity in Ohio until 2027 under the agreement. The investigation alleged the trio collected nearly $149,000 from donors after the February 3rd train derailment. Read the full story at the CBS News website. Joshua Solomon reports in the Times Union that New York's Court of Appeals will hear the latest redistricting case in November. Redistricting is mandated by the U.S. Constitution every 10 years so districts properly represent population shifts. So in 2020, New York changed its districts, but there have been fights in court about those changes ever since. The current court case was filed by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee after Republicans won several New York congressional districts in the 2022 elections. That helped Republicans regain control of the House of Representatives by a narrow margin. Now Democrats have until September 18th to file their legal briefs with the Court of Appeals, and Republicans have until October 23rd to file a response. Previously in this case, the lower court ruled in favor of the Republicans, and then the mid-level court ruled in favor of the Democrats. The case will decide if the current maps are kept until 2030 or if new maps are drawn for New York's congressional districts. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that Representative Mark Molinaro is bringing the pork home to Leeds and Athens in Greene County. Each year, congressional representatives are able to add discretionary spending projects to appropriation bills in what is often pejoratively called pork. The hamlet of Leeds and the village of Athens will get more than $3.5 million for water-related and infrastructure projects if the spending bills are approved by Congress and signed by the President. Greene County Highway and Solid Waste Department Superintendent Scott Templeton said, and I quote, "This is a big boost for Greene County Highway Department, and more specifically, the hamlet of Leeds, as this community project funding will greatly improve not only the stormwater collection system, but also provide safe parking for pedestrians to access the local businesses, including ADA-compliant sidewalks and crosswalks in Leeds," end quote. In all, Molinaro requested $27 million in pork projects throughout the 19th Congressional District. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that Republican Mark Molinaro did not directly comment on the fourth indictment of former President Donald Trump. Democrat Pat Ryan, on the other hand, was not afraid to give his opinion. Ryan, who represents the 18th Congressional District, said on social media, and I quote, "Donald Trump is a traitor who incited and knowingly enabled a violent insurrection, putting our entire nation at risk for his own selfish political gain. His un-American efforts to undermine our democracy represent one of the most egregious threats against our country and our Constitution since its founding," end quote. Molinaro, who represents the 19th Congressional District, said, and I quote, "I still share the concerns that Biden, Clinton, and others are not being held to the same standard as the former president, and that these prosecutions are coming during an active presidential campaign. In the United States, no one should be above the law, and everyone has a presumption of innocence," end quote. Ryan disagreed with Molinaro, even if they use some of the same words, saying, and I quote, "Trump must be held fully accountable under the law and must never hold public office again," end quote. Republican Elise Stefanik, who represents the 21st District, including Rensselaer County, said, and I quote, "President Trump had every legal right to challenge the results of the election," end quote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Melanie Lekasubic reports for Capital Region Independent Media that Representative Mark Molinaro said August 11th that no post offices in the 19th Congressional District have been targeted for closure in a Postal Service consolidation plan. Molinaro is against the postal plan, saying, and I quote, "I am deeply disappointed that the administration at the United States Postal Service is ignorant of and uncaring toward rural and upstate communities, and that needs to change," end quote. State Senator Michelle Hinchy, Democrat, has signed on to a letter with Republican State Senator Rob Rollison to U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy protesting the plan. Assemblyman Chris Teague, a Republican, is against the closing of post offices in theory, but did not address any specifics of the plan. He said, and I quote, "I have always been against post offices closing. It's the one last item of convenience that we have in our small rural areas. It's our last small town local place where folks always go. Besides that, working in the Postal Service offers good paying jobs," end quote. Read more about this story at theupstater.com.
This has been the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Go to WGXC.org for more information.
The climate conflagration rages from Maui to Montana. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Climate change-fueled drought and high winds created the perfect conditions for raging wildfires across the Hawaiian island of Maui last week, burning the historic town of Lahaina to the ground. As of Thursday, the death toll was 111, but that number is expected to go much higher as the difficult task of searching the acres of burnt wreckage slowly proceeds. The number of people killed by the massive conflagration could surpass 1,000. The fire struck on August 8th, not long after the hottest July in recorded human history, and just as a decision was issued in an historic climate trial that took place in Helena, Montana, over 3,000 miles away. There, 16 young Montanans, aged 5 to 22, were suing the state of Montana for violating their constitutional right to a clean and healthful environment. After almost 2.5 years of litigation, Montana Judge Kathy Seeley ruled in favor of the youth plaintiffs, declaring Montana law mandating aggressive promotion of fossil fuels at the expense of the climate was unconstitutional on its face. Vise Fonseca, a tourist visiting Lahaina, told Reuters while at a shelter on Maui.
"We got really real when we saw the flames. And I had to think fast. We had to get out. We left our vehicle. And myself, my wife, and our 5 kids, we all got in the ocean. We found a floating board that we hung on to. And we think we're out there floating, and this is so surreal, and everything is burning around, explosions, cars blowing up, like, embers is flying, we couldn't breathe, we couldn't breathe, there's no air, it's just the carbon monoxide."
Countless stories are emerging of people who ran towards the flames to save a family member, friend, or pet, and perished in the wind-driven 2,000-degree Fahrenheit wall of fire.
"I was born and raised in Maui. I'm Kanaka Maoli, Native Hawaiian, come from 7 generations, and our island is on fire."
Paniela Ng, former member of the Hawaii House of Representatives and now the national director of the Green New Deal Network, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"Our most historic town was set ablaze by wildfires. Hundreds of people have been evacuated and hospitalized. The death toll is climbing, and people are searching for loved ones right now. We're a tropical island here on Maui. We're not supposed to have wildfires. Lahaina Town is actually, it's often characterized as a tourist town, but the people who live there, which should be the focus, tend to be some of the most rooted Native Hawaiians that I've ever met. They're really the keepers of the ancestral knowledge. And to me, the fire is a tragic symbol of this trajectory's terminal point, like where it all ends up if you continue down this mode of extraction as a way to live."
Extraction was central to the case made by the Montana youths who prevailed at the trial. In the same week that Judge Seeley issued her ruling, barring Montana from implementing its pro-fossil fuel laws, the state had 43 active wildfires fanned by record-breaking triple-digit temperatures and high winds.
"Montana is one of the states in our country that has had laws on the books that requires it to promote fossil fuel energy and fossil fuel development at a time when we're in a climate emergency.
That's Julia Olson, chief legal counsel and founder of Our Children's Trust, the nonprofit law group representing the youth plaintiffs, speaking on Democracy Now!
Their laws also required them to ignore the consequences of that and the ways in which greenhouse gas emissions from those fuels fuel the climate crisis. And so these young people used the Montana Constitution, which protects not just their right to a clean and healthful environment, but also their right to dignity, to health and safety and happiness and equal protection of the law.
Julia Olson and Our Children's Trust have similar cases pending in other states, including in Hawaii and in the case known as Juliana versus United States.
In 2015, we filed a case on behalf of 21 youth under the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution against the federal government for its active role in causing the climate crisis. But the Biden administration and the Attorney General Garland and Solicitor General Prelogar are fighting tooth and nail, just like the Trump administration did, to stop this trial.
In one of the most recent court filings in the Juliana case, as reported by Lever News, the Biden administration argued there is no constitutional right to a stable climate system, unquote. The youth plaintiffs of Montana, Hawaii, and elsewhere beg to differ, as do the native Hawaiians and residents of Maui. The climate crisis is not a looming threat. It is here now. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a sunny Sunday with a high of 82 and a south wind around 6 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Sunday night, there's a low around 66 forecast with partly cloudy skies. Monday, there's a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 2 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 82, northwest wind 5 to 8 miles per hour for those windmills, and a low Monday night around 56. Tuesday should be sunny with a high of 73 and a low around 52. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
The New York State Civil Liberties Union released 20 years of New York State police misconduct and force records earlier this month as a searchable database. The information was obtained following the repeal of New York State Civil Rights Law Section 50A. The section basically permitted law enforcement officers to refuse to disclose officer records which were used to evaluate performance toward continued employment or promotion. So basically, 50A made police records secret in New York State. At the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we have been following along as the NYCLU tried to obtain these records at agencies across the state since the appeal of 50A back in 2020. Today, Bobby Hodgson, a supervising attorney with the New York State Civil Liberties Union, along with staff attorney Ife Chikezie, join us to talk about the release of New York State police conduct and force records. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and congratulations. It's been a long road to get to this point of having these records released. You've now obtained tens of thousands of records about police misconduct investigation in the New York State Police. How did you end up finally obtaining these records?
We obtained these records after the NYCLU put in a Freedom of Information Law request, or a FOIA request. As you mentioned, after the repeal of this big police secrecy law, you know, these are documents that the public is entitled to. So we requested these documents. The state police has been pushing back against the release of these documents. So though we've been able to publish publicly for people to, you know, digest and read records about tens of thousands of misconduct allegations, because we had this lawsuit and because we had to then sue the state police to get them to publish these records, we do have a large tranche available, and we are continuing to fight the New York State Police in court so that the other records that we requested and that they have not yet given to us also get released to the public.
Could you just say a little bit more about that? So you got all these records, but there are still more that you would like to release to the public. What's the difference between these two piles of information?
To give you an example, we received information about misconduct, about use of force, and we have names of police officers who are involved in some misconduct investigations that have been quote unquote founded. So one of the several pieces of information that we also requested through our Freedom of Information Law request, and that the state police is unlawfully still withholding from us and from the public, is the names of officers who have been involved in investigations that are not quote unquote founded. That is an important data point because we don't quite know how the state police is finding and not founding certain investigations. So there's a lack of transparency about how this is done. And it could very well be the case that we have officers who have, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of misconduct allegations against them, but we're not able to see that from the data that the state police have shared. They only shared the names of some, but not all of the officers involved in misconduct acts or allegations.
Thanks for going into that a little bit further, Ify. And so now you have this one pile of records, tens of thousands of records, actually. I'm sure you haven't been able to comb through it all, but what are you finding so far? What are some of the takeaways that our audience should know about?
Sure. So we have started combing through it, and we released two public officer lookup tools. It's in our raw databases. So the public, New Yorkers, can also comb through the data with us should they want to. But in terms of some high-level findings, I think the overarching story is quite unambiguous. There are many, many, many thousands, tens of thousands of acts of misconduct. There are over 5,000 use of force incidents that have been reported over this time period. And for diving into each of those on the use of force side, we see officers are regularly using force in incidents like mental health responses or during traffic encounters. And with regards to the acts of misconduct we've seen, we see very little in terms of officer discipline. Approximately half of state police officers who have been involved in misconduct allegations that the state police deems quote unquote founded, over half of them are getting like a slap on the wrist. So something like, say, a reprimand or counseling. So those are a few of the findings. I think the high level story that we've seen from the data, broad strokes, many incidences of use of force, very many incidences of misconduct, and not many instances where we're seeing discipline being meted out.
If you sort of like step back and take in all this data, is there something that most surprised you?
I think, you know, anecdotally here and there that there are instances that like one-off instances that might make headlines where a state police officer uses force. But I guess something that felt like particularly stood out looking at the data were the sheer number of instances that we found over this time period. So almost 20,000 misconduct acts and allegations, over almost 5,000 or over 5,000 use of force instances. So I guess maybe just surprising putting the number behind some of these things that we kind of we knew were happening, but due to the 58 police secrecy law, weren't able to really understand the scope and magnitude of. And again, as I mentioned, there's still information out there that will help us paint an even more holistic picture and help us further contextualize the findings that we've put out.
It's 20 years. Is it spread throughout the two decades, or is it consolidated more in a certain time period, or is it hard to sort of analyze when all of these, I mean, 20,000, you know, misconduct records, that's a lot. Do you have that type of analysis of like?
Pretty consistent over time. So we do have data year over year on these different misconduct, discipline, use of force records from 2000 to 2020. And barring some minor changes in how the state police collected data, the overall story is pretty consistent. We're not seeing a drop off. We're not seeing reductions over time. We're not seeing increased discipline of officers over time. Looking year over year at the data tells a pretty consistent and clear story that has really not changed much at all over the past two decades.
Thanks for that. And, you know, part of your work in this is sharing the information that you attain with the public. You know, you mentioned there's a searchable database, but where does the public find that information? And how are you going about sort of organizing these records to make them accessible to the public?
Sure.